This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today is a special day because with every new month, we have a new Editor's Roundtable. So today we've assembled our editors from around the state to talk about the stuff that's been making headlines and will likely be people, you know, we'll be talking about this stuff for the weeks to come. As regular joins us, Dave Thompson, of course, the news director for Prairie Public. He joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Dave, a pleasure to hear your voice again.
Thank you so much, Doug. Good to hear you.
Kim Wynn is the managing editor of the Grand Forks Herald. She joins us by phone from Grand Forks. Kim, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we should acknowledge that you've been on our air before in this show, but you were formerly with the Bismarck Tribune, so you got a new job now.
That is correct. I've moved from one part of the state to the other, but I'm still in North Dakota.
Fair enough. We all are. Joe Redsky is the news director for KVRR-TV in Fargo. He's also been on our Main Street Editor's Roundtable before. Joe, always a pleasure to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Well, Dave, let's start with something that is out there, has been out there, and is out there new again. A new recreational marijuana ballot measure proposal has been unveiled, and this is from a familiar name. I got this story from Barry Amundson from the Forum News Service, but David Owen in Grand Forks, the leader of Legalize North Dakota, is going to try it again.
Right, and this measure is going to be a little bit more restrictive than the other one that failed by a vote. 55-45, I believe, or almost 60-40. This one's going to put a little bit more limits about possession and will keep some of the higher penalties in for over-possession. Also some things about putting some committees in place to have some oversight over the regulations and a lot of things going on with this measure. And what the supporters of recreational marijuana say, there's still some pent-up anger about the slow rollout of medical marijuana. They hope to build on that when this goes to the ballot.
Kim, is there much talk about this in your newsroom?
Well, there has been, and there are concerns here yet about people's inability to actually access the medical marijuana. And so possibly if there were approval for the recreational marijuana, maybe it would make it easier for those who medically need it, be able to get what they need.
Well, this has been an important topic for a lot of people for years now. And you mentioned the medical marijuana law, which was passed. It was approved. But as I believe Forum News Service a few days ago reported that, you know, it has been a bit of a challenge to find doctors who had the okay to prescribe it.
Absolutely. And I think one of the primary reasons is because it is still not legal at the federal level. And so doctors do have some fear that if they prescribe it, they could have their licenses revoked. I have never heard or seen that happen, but I suppose, you know, theoretically it could.
Well, Joe, I know that Fargo was one of the first places to have a medical marijuana dispensary. Are you chatting about this at KVRR?
We haven't yet. We just came down this afternoon, and so we haven't had a lot of reaction to it yet, but I thought it was interesting that this time the plan could be facing two other ballot issues with the group that's proposing a constitutional amendment to end the prohibition of marijuana in the state and the new state law.
The new state law, so
yeah,
that one has actually been
August
approved.
August 1st, to lower charges for possession of less than half an ounce of marijuana. And so that will be interesting with all three of those available out there, now the public will react.
Well, Dave, we got the new law that takes effect August 1st, and then we might have these competing ballot measures, one a constitutional measure, the other a statutory measure.
Now, some people I've talked to who really support the idea of legalizing recreational marijuana worry about the fact that if you have too many competing measures about the same subject on the same ballot, that may say people may throw up their hands and say, we're going to vote no on all of them and come back in 2 years and try again.
Well, as we know, Shannon Roars from Fargo, who's in the state legislature, was an advocate of lowering the penalties. Those lower penalties do go in effect, as Joe mentioned, August 1st. But you might be splitting hairs here in terms of how they're applied, because I don't know that those penalties have been actually enforced to the limit at this point, have they?
I don't think there's been a lot of cases on it, but there might be a few. haven't had the time to do, you know, any real research into that.
Well, this particular law that takes effect on the 1st of August reduces the misdemeanor charge to an infraction, which I guess is the smallest charge you can bring legally against somebody. Mm-hmm. There are still, of course, fines that would be imposed, and again, against the backdrop of recreational marijuana being legalized, if, again, these petitions are get the proper number of signatures, get on the ballot, and ultimately get approved or, for that matter, disapproved as it was initially. Lots going on here.
Yes. Well, but not to unpack at this point, yeah.
I did notice, though, that this piece that David Owen put together, Kim, relied on sort of the experience of the 11 states where marijuana has been made legal for recreational use. So perhaps there's some wisdom there. I don't know.
Well, I think what is going in the favor this time is the fact that it is more restrictive, not quite so broad as previous. And I think previous proposals were criticized for that, for being too broad.
Well, this is something that we're going to be hearing a lot about, I suspect, because people are going to be out there with their petitions trying to get signatures, and there will be lots of talk about it. So we'll just leave it at that for now and move on to another issue that's been getting a lot of discussion. And who would have thought, Dave, that we'd be talking about the North Dakota State Auditor's position as much as we have?
It's amazing, because let's go back the history real briefly. Toward the end of the session, the auditor's budget was in a conference committee. Representative Corey Mock, a Democrat from Grand Forks, offered this language basically saying for certain audits, the legislature had to give the auditor permission, and that was through the Legislative Audit and Fiscal Review Committee. Well, the Senate didn't have any problem with that language per se, but a number of House members really raised a lot of heck about it on the floor when it came to a debate. And then the auditor weighed in saying, you know, this is a separation of powers matter. Then he asked for an attorney general's opinion. There, same time, a referral was launched to a referral effort. And now the attorney general's come down and say, hey, this looks like an unconstitutional grab of executive power by the legislature. So that's why he said that. Now, Representative Mock has come back and said, hey, we want to take a look at this a little bit further and see if maybe this could be subject to a lawsuit, too. Remember what happened with Governor Burgum and the vetoing of a part of a sentence of a budget bill, plus some concerns that the legislature's budget section had too much power.
Yeah.
So this could end up in the courts again, but it's premature to say that it will.
But at this point, Attorney General Wayne Stengem thinks that if it was to go to the state Supreme Court, the Supreme Court would find in Josh Gallion's favor.
Right, exactly.
And I was intrigued by what Corey Mock was saying about this being about communication and cooperation. that sentence just jumped out at me.
I know. And what the contention of the supporters of this amendment is that the auditor has gone a little bit too far out on his own. And they're saying, hey, we're the budget people. We need to rein him back in. The auditor is saying, look, I'm an elected state official. I'm elected by the people of North Dakota. They gave me a job, and I've got to do my job. So it's a real classic, you know, tug of war between two branches of government.
Was the genesis of this the audit of the North Dakota State College of Science?
I don't think so. I really, you know, nobody has said per se that there's a charge by some people that happened. I do not think so. Some people have said it was the audit that found maybe the governor's travel
was
a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. And they said that's probably part of it. I really don't necessarily think it is. If you want to take Representative Mock at his face value, it was a budget thing, because in performance audits, the audit can charge the performance audit against the agency that's being audited. So I know there was maybe some, you know, backroom complaining about that.
So the auditor, by bringing a performance audit against an agency, can actually cost that agency part of its budget.
It's possible, yes.
And, okay.
Absolutely does happen. The auditor does charge each department for their audits, and that is why some of the legislators are saying that they don't like the performance audits, because those are not scheduled ahead of time. And so it's kind of like a surprise audit, and then the various departments or agencies have not budgeted for that audit.
Maybe yes. That's the wrinkle, Dave, that has to be ironed out here, whether or not there's a pot of money in the state budget for performance audits.
Maybe that's it. You know, that it is an interesting question.
It is an interesting question, because do you want to the state auditor to warn everyone ahead of, like, 6 months to a year ahead of time that,
probably
hey,
not.
We're going to do a performance audit?
Right.
Yeah, but what you really want, I suppose, is those agencies to think there might be a performance audit at any moment. Because
yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we've offered an idea for the legislature. Who knows?
So do we think it is going to the Supreme Court? Or because I think that would be they would have to rule it unconstitutional, right? It can be the judgment of the Attorney General, but it's not. It's just an opinion.
That's right.
That's
now,
right.
The opinion,
right.
An attorney general's opinion has the force of law until challenged in court. So that's why the legislative council is taking a look at this issue and saying, well, maybe there has to be some case that will be brought, and then they can look at the constitutionality of the measure. But there has to be some factual case, from the way I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there would have to be a performance audit that is performed and then an agency is billed. And that might be the case to take it to the Supreme Court, perhaps, as a test.
Well, Josh Gallion right now is a pretty well-known auditor.
Yes, he is.
Right.
And he has a lot of support around the state. And then there are legislators that are saying, wait a second.
Exactly. I mean, how many people know the name of their state auditor? I think Josh Gallion has got to have the most name recognition of anyone right now.
He might be eyeing another place in the Capitol, huh?
Yeah,
who
that
knows?
Could be.
Well, I guess we'll plant that little rumor, too. Let's talk about the search for a new president for the University of North Dakota, Dave, your alma mater, after all.
Yeah, my alma mater, that's right. 11 people have been appointed to it. It's going to be chaired by Casey Ryan and a former faculty member at UND. Dennis Elbert. And I looked at the list. It looks pretty good. But they really want to try to fast-track this. They're not talking about a year, year and a half. They thought they may be able to get, you know, an RFP done. And what they want to put a line in this RFP that says, we prefer somebody who is a UND grad or at least a North Dakota resident, which I find interesting because that has not been done before.
I do, too. I you don't usually see that in the search for a president of a, you know, a major university. Kim, this is a big issue, I suspect, in Grand Forks because the University of North Dakota is a centerpiece of the city.
Absolutely. And it is a hot topic of conversation in Grand Forks. But again, I don't have any insight there. It's all still speculation.
Well, they're looking for, as they've been discussing, a more robust and complete contract for the presidents. I noted that from board member Dan Traynor, which might include an extension of tenure. Now, extension of tenure to a president is somewhat unusual.
It's somewhat unusual, but as it's been approved by the board as a policy matter if the president wants it. And now Mr. Traynor is talking about just basically offering it as a way to offer, you know, somebody the job, you know, as a package, you get tenure. Faculty are nervous about doing that. They say tenure is a, you know, a badge of honor for faculty and may help them get better pay or a better position. And they're just not comfortable at this point by, you know, automatically giving tenure to a college president.
Well, Mark Kennedy, who went off to the University of Colorado system, was only in that job for a relatively short amount of time, and they clearly want to hire a president who's going to hang around.
Right. And so that's one of the carrots. The other stick is that they'd like to put in is that maybe there will be a time limit. You have to commit for like a two-year or three-year deal, something like that.
Well, before we go to break, let's talk briefly here about the interim president of the University of North Dakota, Dr. Joshua Wynn, talking about the student union project, Dave. That's a big project. It's been approved by the students, but he wants a little more information.
Right. Number one, he wants to look at the ins and outs of doing it. He said there is a need to do the project, but he's a little concerned about, you know, this $80 million bond issue, which will be paid over several years by student fees. And he's had this crusade almost to try to reduce the amount of student debt. And that's what he's worried about. He said, we have to look at this to see if everything's fitting together. Yes, the students voted for it back in spring, I think. Is that right, Kim? Do you remember?
I think it was, yeah.
I think it was spring. And he's a little concerned about that. And I don't know what the exact turnout was of students back in spring. So there's a few things at play, and he just wants to answer some questions before he basically says go ahead and issue the bonds.
And, Kim, you spell your last name differently than Joshua Wynn, so we're assuming you're not a relation.
That's right. I don't have the additional E at the end of my name.
Okay. But the student union project, Dave, what you're getting at here, even though the students voted for this increase in their fees, they're literally paying it forward because it takes time to build this $80 million thing they're talking about, and a lot of them will have graduated by the time it opens.
Exactly, and a lot of them are actually putting the burden on students who are now coming up through the system or who have not yet joined the system because it's going to take a while to pay off that $80 million bond.
Yeah, that gets back to Dr. Wynn's idea are we taxing the students for, you know, when they're already paying a lot? So interesting issue, interesting thing to talk about.
And, of course, we have Wynn now again saying that one thing that is non-negotiable for him taking the interim presidency is that he doesn't want the permanent one. He wants to go back to the School of Health. He wants to go back to the med school.
Well, we are holding our monthly editor's roundtable with Dave Thompson, the news director for Prairie Public. He's a regular on this element of our programming. And Kim Wynn, the managing editor of the Grand Forks Herald, and Joe Radsky, news director for KVRR-TV in Fargo. We'll be back and we'll be talking about the North Dakota State College of Science action plan in just a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives. And by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm joined today by our editors' roundtable, Dave Thompson in Bismarck, Kim Wynn in Grand Forks, and Joe Radsky here with me in the studio in Fargo. Dave, this action plan with Chancellor oversight was a headline of your story just last week, the end of the week.
Exactly.
And the State Board of Higher Education has voted to accept an action plan proposed by the North Dakota College of Science at Wahpeton to respond to a performance audit,
yes.
Josh Gallion. So give us a bit of the background here.
Okay, the performance audit said there is a couple of problems. Number one, the auditor said that the State College of Science did not turn over approximately 700 emails concerning the hiring of the Flint Group as the consultant for the new Career Academy for Fargo. And there's also the possibility, and was not filled out, a conflict of interest report because the vice president at NDSES is married to the COO of the Flint Group. And there was some concern there. Well, President Richmond at NDSES said, you know, that vice president, Tony Grinberg, was not involved in the hiring of Flint. And he said that, you know, some of these emails would have been already turned over by the system office. Well, the auditor didn't see it that way. And there was a plan that was worked out by the chancellor and by the chairman of the audit committee of the Board of Higher Education, Kathy Nesset, that the chancellor would undergo a temporary oversight of the campus there, that Richmond would be allowed to continue to be president but would have to run things through the chancellor. Well, President Richmond said, we've got an action plan that we think is better, more comprehensive. And when they put it up to a vote, the first vote was to go with the temporary oversight 4-4, to go with the action plan 4-4. So they took a break, and they came up with this compromise. We're going to go with the action plan, but the chancellor will have oversight of the action plan. So that vote was 6-2, so that's what's going to happen from here on.
I think the confusion for those of us out here listening to this is that who's the president of NDSCS?
John Richmond.
Yes. That I know for sure, but is the chancellor the de facto about things that have to do with the action plan?
Well, it looks like basically a chancellor is going to have some kind of oversight role, maybe more of a consultancy type thing, but he will have some authority, and I'm not exactly sure if everything's written yet about what kind of authority he'll have.
Well, the other issue here, and that I think it kind of lurks in the background, is that NDSCS has been expanding its operation and moving, for that matter, into Fargo a bit.
Right. And as a matter of fact, some of the advertising I've seen online talks about NDSCS Fargo. No, so they are making a dent in Fargo. There's a lot of support among the Fargo business community for NDSCS to get this career academy going in Fargo and to have a presence in Fargo. And also NDSU President Dean Bresciani is also in support of it.
Well, you could say that higher education is one of the most important enterprises in the Fargo-Moorhead area.
You can say that again with the Tri-College system, and now with NDSCS with its presence there. And it is very important to Fargo. And you talk about workforce development and workforce needs, and we know that there is a need in the entire state of North Dakota. That's why the NDSCS people say we need to do this in Fargo.
Okay. Well, stay tuned. Again, these are continuing stories.
I think this is going to be interesting to see how this rolls out.
Okay.
There's a lot of things that are still at play that we don't know yet.
Well, let's talk about something else that we have chatted about before, but not from this point of view. And Dave, just earlier today, you posted a story about the Corrections Department in the state of North Dakota that had hoped to avoid using a prioritization plan because they have too many women inmates.
Right. I think it's 224 women inmates. Well, that number has been reached. And according to legislation passed in 2017, that kicks in the prioritization plan. So as an inmate leaves, who gets to fill that position or who's sent to fill that position has to be somebody, of very serious crimes. You know, AAA felonies are top, and then they go down from there. But if you're talking about overcrowding, that's an interesting issue. There was some concern among a couple of county state's attorneys saying that they're worried that, it might be getting close for the men. But talking to DOCR, they said DOCR meaning the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, they said that it's still about 80 to 85 short for the men. So they think they're going to be able to kind of ride this wave right now and be okay down the road. The big problem, of course, is that the legislature set aside no money for these inmates that have to be kept in county facilities until they can be transferred. So that comes out of county budgets.
Okay. And it's another eye-opener in your story is to note that the system can house 1,624 male inmates and 224 female inmates. Mm-hmm. So gives you a sense of who the principal offenders are.
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we are holding our monthly editors roundtable with Dave Thompson, Kim Wynn, and Joe Radsky. We'll be back with more of our discussion about the stuff that's been making news the last month and will probably for months to come after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The woman accused of shooting two men outside a home in Portland, North Dakota, Friday night is being held on $50,000 cash bond in the Grand Forks County Jail. She's identified as 32-year-old Sadie Ricks.
Currently, the charges are two counts of aggravated assault, and I expect that that'll probably be amended to something other than that, but right now that's where she's at.
Trail County Sheriff Steve Hunt says the two men wounded in the shooting have been released from a Fargo hospital. He says the three know each other. Hunt is limited in what he can say about a motive as this is an ongoing investigation, but he does say the shooting was not drug-related and there is no threat to the public. The interim president of the University of North Dakota says he's excited for the opportunity. Dr. Joshua Wynn has been the vice president for health affairs and dean of the UND Medical School. He received the interim appointment after Mark Kennedy resigned. He says he's very happy with UND's current position.
The direction that has been set is the appropriate one in my view. Our strategic plan that was fully vetted internally and externally is widely accepted both on the campus and around town and throughout the state. And what I'm looking forward to doing is to continue the forward momentum of the university.
So does he have any interest in dropping the interim from his title?
The only non-negotiable that I had when I discussed this with the chancellor prior to taking it was that I would retain my position as vice president for health affairs and dean of the School of Medicine and Health Sciences. The reason for that is that's my first passion, if you will, and I intend to return to that after this interim period is over.
A search committee has been appointed to look for a new president. And Grand Forks Mayor Mike Brown is attending the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Honolulu, Hawaii. While discussing common problems among youth with the 300 mayors in attendance, Brown says there are widespread problems they all can relate to.
Well, it was interesting. We had a membership committee meeting, and the mayor from Hawaii presented his problems with opioid youth addiction and suicide in their youth. And you go, that's a very common problem throughout, and we need to address this opioid crisis in our communities because losing one child is too many.
Another major concern is the future of our infrastructure.
I think potholes, it's amazing how common potholes are across this country, and people have failing infrastructure. So we need to start investing in that, and our governments have been neglecting reinvesting in our infrastructure. So as communities, we need to push that forward so that we don't face the same problems in 50 to 100 years that we're facing now.
Mayor Brown says the main goal of the conference is for the mayors to learn from one another and bring successful practices back to their own communities. The conference will meet again this winter in Washington, D.C. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're conducting our monthly editor's roundtable with our news director, Dave Thompson, who's with us in Bismarck, Kim Wynn, the managing editor of the Grand Forks Herald by phone from Grand Forks, and Joe Radsky, the news director for KVRR-TV in Fargo with me here in studio. There's a big, big business and health story out there that I just caught wind of about a week ago. And that's this plan for Sanford to merge with an Iowa group, which would form an even larger medical organization than Sanford now is. We're talking multi-billions here in revenue, Dave. And Sanford is everywhere in the state, in the region for that matter.
Absolutely. Sanford has become a real huge player in the medical industry, if you want to put it that way. And this is going to be, I think, 83,000 staff and 2,600 physicians.
That's just amazing.
26 states, 9 countries. That is just amazing to me.
And meanwhile, Kim, Grand Forks is home to Altru. I suspect that everybody's sort of waiting for shoes to drop.
Well, there actually has been speculation on how interesting would it be if Sanford and Altru were to merge. I'm not seeing that at this point. We also do have to remember that a proposed merger in Bismarck was not approved because of reasons of competition.
And that's right. That was Mid-Dakota Clinic to merge
with right.
Sanford.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Iowa group is called Unity Point, but I think the sheer size of this, and Dave, you hinted at a bit of it there, is a reminder of how big an industry healthcare is.
It certainly is. And, you know, if you want to see big, well, you might as well look at the Sanford Hospital in Fargo. That is a huge, huge place. And, Joe, if I remember correctly, I think that almost has reached capacity already.
Has it? Yeah. I've been hearing
they're already talking about adding new facilities to that footprint out there.
That's what I understand.
And all you have to do is go down Veterans Boulevard or go down 45, and you see all the new apartments and the condos and the housing and the businesses, and so the effect of Sanford, and if it was to grow larger, how that would even impact the economy here in town.
Yeah, it's amazing, Dave, that, you know, the center of Fargo is roughly around 25th Street and about 30th Avenue South now. And that part of that is the Sanford explosion is certainly indicative of that.
Understood, yes.
Because the growth in this community, which, you know, Fargo and West Fargo used to be distinctly separate. Now you don't know when you've crossed into one unless you're looking at the street signs very carefully.
Very true.
But there's another issue with Sanford that has hit the news, and I know it was in Forum Communications papers just recently, but it originated at the Sioux Falls Argus Leader by Jonathan Ellis, the reporter there. And this is, I think, a very troubling headline for this very big operation. And that headline is, Sanford Health, top Sioux Falls surgeon defrauded millions from government, complaint alleges. And the complaint, the allegations come from Sanford doctors. So what do we make of that? Because this is a, you know, pretty big allegation against a very big organization.
Well, I think we all have to be more aware of our hospitals and doctors and making sure that they're not further pushing up our health care costs, because they're already just ridiculous. So I hope that that situation, people take a look at it, maybe learn something from it if there was something that didn't go quite right.
Well, it involves a neurosurgeon who works with Sanford, basically doing procedures that involve medical devices that he's connected to, the company that creates these medical devices. And, of course, the patients ultimately pay for whatever the procedure or the device is. And this particular doctor has had allegations brought before, which and penalties were paid before. So this is something that one would think Sanford's management would have been somewhat aware of and quite sensitive to. But
you would think so, absolutely. And maybe now that it will be taken more seriously. I don't think there's any choice at this point.
Right, that's for sure, because this is medical fraud is the allegation, and the ramifications could be severe for, you know, a major healthcare provider that relies to a certain extent on government support for the patients it serves. That could be at risk. So stay tuned for this one.
So this is one that's almost it's hard to wrap my mind around it about you know what this actually means. But your point is well taken about hospitals do depend on some government help, especially if you're taking in Medicare patients.
Yeah, and I guess there are other shoes perhaps dropping here. We'll probably be reading more about this, and our thanks to the Sioux Falls paper for bringing it to our attention. The Sioux Falls Argus Leader, where, frankly, I mean, Sanford originated in Sioux Falls. Joe, you mentioned as we were planning to the things we were going to discuss today about a homelessness report by the FM Coalition to End Homelessness and the results that came out of that. Share that with our listeners.
Yeah, they came back saying that there were up to 1,000 people who are looking for a home every night, look for a place to sleep every night, and they brought up that some of the causes that they're working on are employment issues, transportation, and mental health. And the one that kind of jumped out in our report was that 30% of the people surveyed, those who said that they were looking for a place to stay, have jobs, and work an average of 24 hours a week, and that kind of points out that it's not the person who cannot work and stays on the street 24/7, but that family or that couple or that woman with her children who needs a place to stay maybe 1 week a month, and they are the FM Coalition does a terrific job here in town and is just, you know, looking for some answers, and they brought the report to the public to try to find out how they can get those numbers down.
Well, homelessness is an issue just about everywhere. Kim, were you going to jump in there?
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that the people within the survey, I think a large portion of them are not what you think of as stereotypically homeless
yes.
people. They may be sleeping on a friend's couch, maybe staying with mom and dad for another night, you know, whoever, some other night. And they also may be hauling some children around with them as well.
So there are lots of issues tied up with that, and some of them have to do with the cost of daycare. Some of them have to do with the minimum wage. Some of them have to do with that other significant percentage of people who can't work because, you know, 1,000 out of a potential population of 250,000 isn't huge, but there are going to be, you know, people who are, you know, grappling with their own demons and perhaps aren't suitable for anybody's employment at this point.
And if you don't have a high enough paying job, it doesn't even pay to work if you have to hand the entire paycheck over to child care. Then you're kind of out of options.
And that's right, Kim. Yeah, that brings up a perfect point that a lot of families, it's less expensive to just be with their children than to have them watched by someone and take a job that you can't even pay for the daycare. You're right.
And the other issue here is the cost of housing. We have had an ongoing debate about the development, the very robust development that's going on all over Fargo-Moorhead, but especially in downtown Fargo right now, and the fact that they're adding lots of apartments, but maybe not everybody can afford to live in them.
I think that's a challenge all over the state. I hear that in Bismarck. I hear that in Minot, about the challenge to find affordable housing. And remember, when during the oil boom, housing prices went through the roof and they had trouble finding affordable housing, so some people had to leave, the Tiogas and the Crosbys and the Williston's, to find affordable housing in eastern North Dakota, and that is becoming a challenge too.
Yes. We remember back not that many years ago at the height of the boom when Williston had the highest cost of living, I think, in the country.
I think that's right.
I think their cost of for an actual apartment exceeded New York's average at that point.
At one point it did. Same with Watford City, which was very interesting.
Yeah. So this is an ongoing issue and one that probably requires some policy tweaks somewhere. At any rate, the legislature doesn't convene for another year or so.
Right, but it'll be one of the studies that I think Commerce is looking at the study, and I think there's another interim committee that's taking a look at that whole study about affordable housing.
Well, another issue that's been ongoing and that we've talked about quite a bit, and I know the legislature has wrestled with this a bit, and you filed this story earlier this month, Dave, opioid prescriptions dropped more than 14% in 2018. Compared with the year before. So that's probably a good trend.
Right. And this is an effort by the American Medical Association to try to get doctors to do less prescribing of opioids because of the worry that is such an addictive drug to a lot of people. And 14.3% from the previous year, those look pretty good. And the chief medical officer for Sanford and Bismarck said Sanford did some things starting in 2016 to start ratcheting back the amount of opioids that are prescribed. They're saying that we don't want to eliminate them entirely because they do help some patients, but you do worry about the potential for overdoses.
Yes, and of course there are these legal battles that are ongoing between various states and the producers of the opioid prescription products.
And some cities, too. There are a couple cities in North Dakota that are going off on their own and suing the manufacturers, too.
This is getting a lot of attention nationwide, and we are reminded that these are very powerful drugs. And the opioid epidemic, one of the sidebars of that is the fentanyl epidemic, because if you can't afford or can't get a prescription for an opioid, maybe you can find something on the street that's even more powerful and more dangerous.
Real problem there because of fentanyl. You don't hear it quite as often these days, but still, fentanyl's out there. And that's a real concern.
Well, there have been lots of deaths recorded right in our cities and in our state that have been attributed to this terrible problem.
Mm-hmm. And that's why it's kind of important for patients to have access to this medical marijuana at this point in time as doctors are ratcheting down prescription opioids, those who are really suffering from pain do need some alternative.
Well, medical marijuana has been touted as a treatment for some types of chronic pain, and perhaps that will make some of these larger organizations that have lots of doctors reconsider what, if they're not policies or implied policies, about prescribing this assistance. Another issue, Joe, that you reminded us of today was that Senator Kevin Cramer, a North Dakota Republican, and Senator Tina Smith, a Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party member, have been working together to introduce legislation to reduce the cost of insulin. This has been a big story as well.
Very big. And as we here at KVRR are very tied with the JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Group, and we've heard stories of couples and families having to go up to Canada to buy insulin, and their insurance may pay for it, but it just costs overwhelming the cost of insulin these days, and the Smith and Cramer bill would then penalize manufacturers for excessive price increases, and I think a lot of people, it seems like a lot of people in Washington, I know Klobuchar has talked about this as being an issue, and it's something that is touching a lot of families' lives here in the FM and through, of course, North Dakota, also that hopefully can be somehow taken down, similar to the opioid, crisis and the lawsuits and the legal battles with them.
But you really hate to hear people profiteering from something that is as common and it frankly is a growing issue, a health issue with millions of people, which is diabetes.
Exactly.
So here's hoping that
What was the legislation in Minnesota that was being talked about, an emergency insulin program?
That I don't know the details of it. I think a lot of states have been grappling with this that because there are so many people who – and, of course, we know it's endemic among certain populations that are poor to begin with and that may even be more put at risk because of the rising cost of the thing that sustains their life.
Yeah, it all began against Dave was when – it was because Governor Waltz – he called for a special session just to address the insulin bill after they failed to pass it. Alex Smith, who passed away, 26-year-old Minneapolis man who died from complications from diabetes after rationing his insulin. But their bill would help uninsured patients underinsured patients to get short-term supplies of insulin if they can't afford it.
I'm just struck by how much time we have spent talking about health care, the cost of health care, the ramifications of big pharma, frankly, being able to basically, we will supply what the demand and we will set the price for it. This is a national issue and an international issue when you're going to Canada to get your insulin. So
I think that's absolutely true. And, while insulin is a high-profile drug at this time, my guess is there are a lot of, especially senior citizens and others, who are not taking their medication as directed just because they can't afford it.
Yeah. Ouch. Let's move on to another topic here, and that is, Dave, the Budget Stabilization Fund which was drained a bit because of some important needs at a time when the state's budget was a bit tight.
Mm-hmm. It was completely drained.
Yeah, it's refilling, though, and at a pretty good clip.
It is, and shows you the volatility of the commodity-based economy that we have in North Dakota. Oil prices went back up. Oil revenue started flowing again. People are, the companies are completing wells that were sitting idle for a while. And that money's coming back. And now they think that the Budget Stabilization Fund will get to a place where it will fill. And then the rest, if you have overage, then it goes back into the general fund. What happens is the general fund gets to a level of $60 million. Then money goes into the Budget Stabilization Fund. That's capped at about $725 million based on a percentage of the budget that's coming up. If it gets to $725 million, money flows back into the general fund. So We have a good rainy day fund that appears to be going to be filled by the end of the biennium. And, hey, that's good. That's a good hedge against another sudden downturn.
Well, it's a reminder that the state's economy is largely commodity-driven, and the fossil fuels part of that has been robust recently, at least relatively so. The ag one less so, though. And let's talk a bit about these trade issues that are out there. I noted that you had a story a while back, and I think all of us have been following this, about the trade relations we have with some important countries like Canada and Mexico and China. Mm-hmm. And the governor of North Dakota, Doug Burgum, and other GOP governors are urging Congress to pass the United States-Mexican-Canadian trade agreement. So,
and if I remember correctly, only Mexico has passed it, correct?
I believe so, although I think there's a fair amount of reluctance among some people in Congress about this particular the redrawing of what was NAFTA, after all, has formed.
And there are several. You have different camps, of course, and you have different camps in all three countries. Some people say it's better than NAFTA. Some people say it's worse than NAFTA. And I, you know, if I were a trade expert, I'd probably look at it and come up with my own conclusion. But there's a real push on to get Congress to do something and then the Parliament in Canada to do something. It'll be interesting to see if that happens.
Well, you can see that the country is sensitive to it. I mean, the stock market reacts almost immediately when the United States and China just even talking about trade. So there's a sensitivity there. And in the meantime, there are a lot of producers, growers in North Dakota of soybeans and corn, et cetera, canola, that are really in a bind.
Right. And, you know, corn and soybeans especially, that's a real concern. And corn for ethanol is a real concern.
So. And worry, too. I know that we've all heard from farmers who are concerned that some of the soybean product that China was buying and has gone to – they've been buying from others, and it may be a while before they actually do come back and begin to keep some of our farmers alive here.
Well, I'm going to move on to another issue. I was just recently out in Medora, and I talked to Randy Hatzenbuehler, who heads up the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. They kind of run the Medora attraction, which is a premier tourist attraction in North Dakota, particularly this time of year. And everybody was very, very excited about the prospect of a Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, Dave.
That's right. Yet it was passed by the legislature. And now there is a group that it wants to refer that to voters. But it's interesting because there's a $50 million commitment from the state, $15 million from the general fund, $35 million as a loan to the Bank of North Dakota to set up an endowment fund. The legislature put an emergency clause on that. So that's taken effect, and that's already state law right now. And the governor is confident they're going to get the $100 million of private funds that they need to raise to pull the trigger on this. And he said, you know, if we get the $100 million, he thinks it's going to be hard for people to vote against it because $100 million's in place, then you've got the cash in hand. You borrow $35 million from the bank, $15 million comes from the general fund, get $150 million.
Yeah, there is actually a lot of very rich people internationally, just throughout the country, who are very interested in having this library simply because there just isn't one for Theodore Roosevelt.
And it's a triple whammy for the state because it would be the Presidential Library, the Medora attraction, and Theodore Roosevelt National Park. So
absolutely.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. Our editor's roundtable has run out of room. Kim Nguyen, managing editor of the Grand Forks Herald, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Joe Radsky, always a pleasure to have you in studio. Joe is the news director for KVRR-TV in Fargo.
Thank you very much.
And Dave Thompson, our stalwart out in Bismarck, our news director for Prairie Public. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Okay. Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 1st. North Dakota remembers Teddy Roosevelt, marking 100 years since his passing, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. Theodore Roosevelt's bold and bountiful reputation as an American icon had its genesis with the Rough Riders in the short, bloody, but significant Spanish-American War to free the Cubans from the tyranny of Spain. This week in 1898 launched T.R. into history. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, but following the explosion of the battleship Maine in Cuba's Santiago Harbor, he resigned to recruit a group of volunteers for the 1st United States Volunteer Cavalry. 38-year-old, newly appointed Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt served under Colonel Leonard Wood. 23,000 American men applied for the regiment, from aristocratic Eastern Ivy League graduates to flinty Western cowboys. An adoring press gave the regiment many creative names before settling on the alliterative Roosevelt's Rough Riders. It was on this date in 1898 that Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt and his men charged a heavily fortified rampart in the San Juan Hills. The battle changed his life.
"We will have this war for the freedom of Cuba. The blood of women and children who have perished by the 100,000 in hideous misery lies at our door. The instant I received the order, I sprang on my horse and my crowded hour began, the heaviest loss suffered by any regiment in the cavalry division. I suppose every man tends to brag about his regiment, but it seems to me that there never was a regiment better worth bragging about than ours. I am proud without measure, because it is a typical American regiment. The foundation of the regiment was the cowpuncher. The men of the West, horsemen, riders, and herders of the cattle, have been the backbone of our regiment, which demonstrates that Uncle Sam has another reserve of fighting men to call upon if necessity arises."
America discovered a new hero on that portal to the 20th century. Biographer Edmund Morris observed, "Theodore Roosevelt emerged from the battlefield the most famous man in the world." Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear.
Washington, D.C. prosecutors think they've found a better way to keep their community safe, by connecting young people with those they've harmed. But are the victims willing to participate?
If this was my son and somebody saw an opportunity to help him, I would hope that person would take that opportunity.
Plus, we talk with Chicago's mayor as she gets ready for possible ICE raids in her city. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll hear about the Artist in Residency Program, which supports North Dakota artists demonstrating for state park visitors. We'll talk with Amy Schimetz from the Parks and Recreation Department and the State Arts Council's Kim Conico. And we'll visit with Sarah Heitkamp, the Executive Director of the Nelson County Arts Council, about the recent Pekin Days Art Show. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.